Stand at any airport gate and watch. Hundreds of people staring downward, bathed in blue light, each inhabiting their own digital bubble while CNN blares overhead. This isn't just modern life. It's a fundamental crisis in how we experience reality. Your attention has become the most valuable commodity in the world, and everyone wants a piece. Gas pumps now force you to watch ads while filling your tank. Social media algorithms fight invisible wars for milliseconds of your consciousness. We've arrived at a strange moment. The silence needed for thinking has become a luxury good, available only to those who can afford business class lounges. Meanwhile, the rest of us have our minds strip-mined like natural resources, our capacity for sustained thought auctioned off to the highest bidder. Ever notice how you instinctively look away when trying to remember something important? That blank stare into space isn't your brain randomly wandering. It's desperately trying to suppress environmental input so it can think. This ability emerged around age 2 or 3, when you first learned to organize experience into coherent stories. Unlike other animals who simply react to whatever's in front of them, humans developed this remarkable capacity to recall memories not triggered by immediate surroundings. But here's the catch. This only works when your environment isn't screaming for attention. The average person checks their phone 96 times daily, roughly once every 10 minutes. Your brain is trying to maintain an integrated sense of self while 1,000 notifications compete for dominance. It's like trying to have a deep conversation at a rock concert. The evolutionary mechanism that made human consciousness possible is being systematically dismantled by technologies that treat your attention as an extractable resource. We're not just distracted, we're losing the cognitive infrastructure that makes coherent selfhood possible. Genuine autonomy emerges not from unlimited choices, but from submitting to things with their own intractable ways. A master chef doesn't see random ingredients. She perceives potential combinations, flavor profiles, cooking times simultaneously. Years of practice discipline her perception until choice becomes automatic, creating an ecology of attention where skilled engagement replaces deliberate decision-making. The carpenter experiences wood grain as guide, not constraint. This contradicts our modern notion that anything beyond your own head threatens freedom. The truth? Your environment doesn't compromise yourself. It actively constitutes it. When you first use a long probe to explore unseen space, you feel pressure against your hand. With practice, the probe becomes transparent. You stop feeling it and start perceiving directly through it. This reveals something crucial. Perception isn't something that happens to you, but something you do. Experiments with kittens proved this. Those allowed to move freely developed normal vision, while passive kittens receiving identical visual stimulation remained effectively blind. Self-directed motion isn't incidental to perception, it's essential. Motorcycle riding demonstrates this beautifully. To turn left at speed, you counter-steer right. The bike goes wherever you look, including obstacles you're avoiding. Most riders never consciously learn this. Their bodies integrate visual cues with balance and motion until thought disappears into action. A carpenter's jig constrains wood to guide repeated cuts, a simple tool representing how we structure our relationship with the world. When skilled practitioners seed their environment with attention-directing objects, they create cognitive scaffolding that makes excellence possible. A busy kitchen becomes an extension of the cook's mind. Orders, timing, spatial relationships integrated into fluid performance. The cook creates and adjusts these structures flexibly, maintaining command over their actions. Contrast this with behavioral economists' nudges, administrative interventions exploiting psychological biases to make people act virtuously without developing virtue. Setting retirement plans to opt out rather than opt in increases participation but bypasses character development entirely. We once had robust cultural jigs, the Protestant ethic linking wealth to spiritual election, Republican values connecting financial independence to democratic participation. Consumer credit dismantled these mutually reinforcing norms, leaving us with thin administrative nudges trying to make us act right without being right. The difference matters. One approach develops human capacity through engagement. The other treats us as psychological mechanisms to be manipulated. Education derives from Latin, meaning to lead out, perhaps to be led out of oneself. Iris Murdoch described learning Russian as confronting an authoritative structure which commands my respect, revealing something existing independently of the learner. True musical expression comes through prior obedience to one's instrument, to natural musical necessities, to cultural forms. Watch a jazz ensemble. Individual expression emerges from collective understanding of harmony and rhythm. Like a martial artist gaining freedom by mastering prescribed forms, genuine autonomy emerges from engagement with authoritative structures that expand our capacities. Early Mickey Mouse cartoons were hilarious because they exaggerated how material reality thwarts human will. Objects had weight, momentum, unpredictability. They inflicted what philosophers call heteronomy on Mickey's plans, creating slapstick comedy that affirmed the human condition. Today's Mickey Mouse Clubhouse presents a radically different world. When problems arise, characters summon the handy-dandy machine, which provides ready-made solutions from a menu of mousketools. Each episode guarantees four solvable problems with four corresponding tools, eliminating genuine conflict between will and world. This makes the show, somehow, the opposite of funny. It's not depicting experience, but managing psychology. To be a mouskadoer means abstracting from material reality with its hazards and friction. But hazards are inseparable from opportunities. They're two sides of the same coin in the world where we acquire embodied skills. John Muir's 1969 Volkswagen manual colorfully suggested driving as if strapped to the front of the car like Aztec sacrifices. Today's Mercedes offers attention assist packages. Modern cars deliberately insulate drivers from mechanical reality through throttle-by-wire, brake-by-wire, and countless assist systems, creating a poverty of information that fails to engage natural sensory capabilities. Older cars provided rich, immediate feedback. When a brake rotor warps, you experience it through multiple channels: tactile feedback through pedal pressure, oscillation sounds, burning brake material. This cross-modal binding of sensory inputs is how we grasp reality through mechanical interaction. Modern vehicles with impoverished feedback promote cognitive regression. The principle is simple: involve your body and your mind will follow. Yet the industry increasingly offers falsification as remedy. Mercedes' enhanced reality windshields, BMW's artificial engine sounds piped through speakers. Las Vegas casinos track players through loyalty cards and facial recognition. Some machines even call gamblers by name when cameras detect them approaching exits. This precision engineering exploits a brutal truth. Players don't seek excitement, but tranquility, describing the experience like a tranquilizer. Machine design accelerates play relentlessly. Electronic buttons replace mechanical handles, video screens replace physical reels, bill acceptors eliminate coin handling. Video poker players now complete 1,200 hands hourly, quadruple the rate from decades ago. Even losses register as wins, with flashing lights triggering dopamine rewards. The industry obsesses over continuous gaming productivity through increased speed, duration, and wager amounts. Every design element eliminates disruptions to extend time on device. Cashless gambling removes the psychological closure of handling money. Players are studied to discover optimal play rates, creating environments where they remain comfortable until playing to extinction, until all funds are depleted. Advanced stage gamblers stop caring about winning. They seek only the zero balance that brings release. One gambler named Sharon no longer even looks at her cards. You accept the certainty of chance. The proof is the zero at the end. They report annoyance at winning jackpots, compelled to zero out the tension. This reveals what Freud called the death instinct. Beneath our life-seeking drives lies a primitive desire to return to stillness. This same logic pervades our relationship with technology. We seek friction-free experiences promising effortless satisfaction, yet find ourselves trapped in cycles that drain rather than energize, that numb rather than awaken. In Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, George Taylor and John Booty craft world-class pipe organs through mechanical forensic archaeology, reverse engineering ancient instruments to recover historical techniques. When restoring a 1965 organ whose space-age plastic parts had melted after 35 years, they replaced them with traditional wood, felt, and leather. Yet, they aren't dogmatic. They eagerly adopt carbon fiber for trackers because it's stable, strong, and stays straight. Their work reveals tradition as rationality, not nostalgia. Deep immersion in particular crafts trains concentration and perception, developing what philosopher Michael Polanyi calls personal knowledge, judgment infused with emotional involvement. Historical inheritance doesn't burden these craftspeople, but energizes innovation as they engage critically with past designs. This renaissance of small-batch specialty manufacturing offers guidance for the new economy, not through generic flexibility, but through deep competence in particular practices that shape both attention and identity. Submission to what's real, whether Russian grammar, musical tradition, or wood grain, doesn't diminish the self, but develops it. Affection for the world as it is could serve as a motto for living well in an age of manufactured realities. Original Disney cartoons showed Donald Duck skating on frozen lakes, incorporating real branches and snowdrifts into balletic performance-heightened versions of actual skill that inspire wonder at how the world's affordances align with human capability. Being alert to these possibilities is fundamentally erotic, drawing us toward beauty and excellence. Our attraction to what's genuinely good connects us to others without abstraction. When we notice particular excellence in previously invisible people, we truly see their humanity, not through principled empathy projected from afar, but through recognition of their striving for distinction. Education must reclaim this reality through embodied learning. As woodshop teacher Doug Stowe notes, schools create artificial learning environments students know are contrived and undeserving of their full attention. When a student builds a race car chassis, trigonometry becomes fascinating, not as abstract knowledge, but as pragmatic power. A boy admiring race car drivers might learn trigonometry to become a fabricator, discovering beauty in a perfect weld bead along the way. Reality encountered through skilled engagement offers what no screen can provide: the development of selves capable of genuine attention, real freedom, and authentic love for what actually exists. A rock climber experiences the cliff face as a field of positive affordances, handholds, friction points, rest positions. Escaping heteronomy through abstraction means substituting technology as magic for genuine agency, losing the ability to be mentally present and to develop the depth of character that comes only through sustained engagement with what's genuinely real.